When we look out at the universe, even with our naked eyes, we can see stars, planets, our moon, deep sky objects, and the vast expanse of the Milky Way, all right here from the ground on planet Earth. The Milky Way, we didn't know what it was for thousands of years. For most of human history and all of prehistory, it was only about 100 years ago that we discovered that actually the Milky Way is just one galaxy like the many, many others we now know trillions of other galaxies present in the observable universe. But what do we find when we peer past what we can see in visible light, past the light blocking dust and neutral matter in the galactic plane to reach the center of the Milky Way galaxy? How do we find out what's going on in there? Find out on this edition of the Starts With a Bang podcast. The Milky Way is our cosmic home. We're located about 27,000 light years from the galactic center. And although we've looked with telescopes since the invention of the telescope, we haven't been able to penetrate in visible light what lies behind these great clouds of light-blocking neutral matter. However, we have a series of tricks we can use. We're not confined to looking in the same wavelengths of light that our eyes can see. We can leverage a technique called using multi-wavelength astronomy, from short waves like X-rays all the way to the longest waves of all, like radio waves. And here to help us explore how we do this, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Dr. Natalie Butterfield. Natalie is an assistant scientist at NRAO, the National Radio Astronomy Observatories, and she presented some wonderful research this past January at the American Astronomical Society's meeting, which is where I got the chance to meet her. And now I'm so excited to have her here on the Starts With a Bang podcast. Natalie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this. So if I wanted to look at the galactic center, visible light, optical wavelengths of light are no good. Why can't I see through the material in the galactic plane to see the center of the galaxy in visible light? And why can I see through to the center of the galaxy in other wavelengths of light?
Well, Ethan, that's a great question. So we can't observe the center of the galaxy in optical light due to an effect that's called extinction. And so extinction is caused by all of these gas and dust clouds that are located in the disk of the galaxy. So this is in the spiral arms of the Milky Way galaxy between us and the center. So any optical light that is coming from the center of the galaxy basically gets absorbed and re-emitted at the infrared wavelengths. So we cannot actually observe the center of the galaxy at infrared, or at optical wavelengths. We have to observe the center of the galaxy at other wavelengths like radio and infrared. And the reason why we can see the center of the galaxy at these longer wavelengths is due to the fact that the path length, so basically the path that light takes to reach us from the center of the galaxy, is much longer. So you don't run into those extinction effects that you do at optical wavelengths. And so radio is one of the more common instruments or wavelengths that we observe the center of the galaxy in.
Does this work the same way my microwave oven works, where I turn on the microwave and I can see through to it because visible light is getting through those little holes in the screen on the microwave door, but the microwaves stay inside, which is why the food inside get cooked and not the people outside get cooked, that microwaves have these longer wavelengths of light so they can't pass through the microwave holes in the door? Is extinction kind of like that, that the short wavelength optical light gets absorbed by the material there, but these longer wavelengths of light, like infrared and radio, they don't get absorbed by the material in the interstellar medium?
It's somewhat similar. It's more similar to if you have a cloud that passes in front of the sun and starts to block out the sun, and it starts to get darker outside. It's very similar. I mean, the sun is much closer to us than the center of the galaxy. So the radiation or the light that you're seeing from the sun is much stronger than the light that we're seeing from the center of the galaxy. But it's fairly similar, where you have something that is passing, a cloud that is passing between us and the illuminating source, so the center of the galaxy in that case. And so the light that you're seeing is blocked. So that would be a very similar kind of analogy to what we're seeing with the center of the galaxy. Now, with your microwave oven, you do have almost like a cage that is blocking any of the radiation that you are getting from your microwave oven in there. And so, yes, so optical light is able to pass through those little holes, but because you have this metal mesh wiring around your internal region of your microwave oven, that tends to block the microwaves from escaping and heat up your food.
Well, that's good to know. So if I think about these clouds in our atmosphere, they're made out of, you know, water and water vapor. But if I think of the clouds that I have in interstellar space, these are made more out of dust, aren't they? These are made out of mostly tiny dust grains and complex molecules that are, you know, either in the gaseous or solid form. This is what's blocking my light in interstellar space, right?
Yes, that's correct. So most of these clouds that we're seeing are dusty clouds. So you've got little dust grains in there, and then on the surfaces of these dust grains are where you get molecules that are forming. So a lot of molecules, especially the smaller molecules like carbon monoxide or water molecules, are thought to form on these dust grains, where you get little atoms of hydrogen, oxygen kind of moving around on these surfaces of these dust grains. And then they interact with other molecules or other atoms to form these molecules that we observe. And then they get knocked off of these dust grains and into the gas phase. And that's when we can see them with other types of spectroscopy instruments, using radio facilities like the VLA, which is the Very Large Array in New Mexico, or the ALMA array, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter array that's located down in Chile. So a lot of these radio instruments are used in spectroscopy mode to detect these different molecules from these dusty clouds or molecular clouds. It's a little bit different than what we observe in our own atmosphere, since a lot of the molecules that we observe in our atmosphere are water molecules. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't water out in space. So we do detect water towards many star-forming sites. So water is a molecule that we can detect in interstellar medium as well, but it's not nearly as common as a molecule like carbon monoxide, which is one of the more common molecules to observe out in space.
You know, I think this is really fascinating, right? You talked about spectroscopy, and normally I think most of us think about spectroscopy as like, oh, well, we're taking light and we're breaking it up into its individual component wavelengths. And the reason we're doing this is that we're going to see bright spots and faint spots. And the bright spots that appear correspond to what we call emission lines, where you have an atom or a molecule that you have it being excited, being sent into an excited state where the electrons within it are kicked up out of the ground state to a higher energy level, and then they de-excite and they emit light that you can detect. So by doing that, you can say, oh, I'm looking for water molecules, or I'm looking for hydroxyl ions, or I'm looking for carbon monoxide, or I'm looking for ammonia, or you can pick whatever molecules you're looking for. And when you see those lines coming in at those wavelengths that correspond to those atoms or molecules, you can say, aha, now I can map this out. But if you're not interested in the emitting stuff, you can also go and look for the absorptive stuff, the stuff where you say, okay, well, we have this background of light that's, you know, relatively continuous, or we're looking at a background object that emits light, and I know how much light that emits, but I can see at certain wavelengths, there are these dips in the spectrum. It's like that same feature that would be an emission line if I had excited atoms or molecules, they are absorptive when they're neutral, because that light comes in, these atoms or molecules absorb the light at that specific wavelength. And then when I look at my spectrum, I say, oh, there's a dip, there's a big missing feature there. And so are these the two main techniques we use, spectroscopic emission and absorption, to detect features at these radio wavelengths dependent on whatever it is specifically that you're interested in and looking for?
Yeah, for the most part, those are the two main ones. You can have scattering, which is where you get light that is reflected off of different types of astronomical features. It's not quite as common as emission or absorption. But those are the two main ones that we typically use to study the center of the galaxy and a lot of different clouds that are within the galaxy. Which is different than looking at any sources in what's known as continuum. And continuum is where you have broad emission across a wide range of different frequencies or wavelengths. And so a lot of these different sources would be, for example, like the sun. The sun emits in continuous wavelength across all different types of optical wavelengths, you know, from red all the way down to blue. So even though most of the light that we see from the sun is, you know, yellow or, you know, around 5,500 angstroms, typically most of, you know, the light that we're seeing from the sun is broad. And so you're seeing it across multiple wavelengths, not just a single wavelength, which is what you would get for emission or absorption.
And when we look in radio, we're not just seeing like, oh, okay, there's some dust and I can see where the gas on this dust is absorbing light or emitting light. We also have scattered throughout the Milky Way and also far beyond, we also have these bright, I'll call them radio sources, don't we? What are some objects that emit large amounts of radio light? So when we see these sort of bright objects with radio telescopes, what are some of the things that appear bright in radio light?
Yeah, so there's different types of radio, like continuous radio emission that you can get. So one of them is called synchrotron emission. So synchrotron emission is where you have an electron that is orbiting around a magnetic field. So it's spiraling around a magnetic field relativistically. So these are moving at speeds that are very close to the speed of light. These electrons are moving around the magnetic field. And so they emit radiation that's called synchrotron emission. And so a lot of the sources where you would see synchrotron emission would be like pulsars, fast radio bursts emit a synchrotron emission. So a lot of the really high energy phenomena. One of the other types of emission that you can get at radio wavelengths is called, the technical term is called Bremsstrahlung, but it's also known as free-free emission, and it traces a lot of H2 regions, which are these ionized regions around star-forming sites. So you have the electron and proton have disassociated in the hydrogen atom, so you have these free-floating particles. And so because you have all of these different free-floating particles due to the radiation of nearby stars or high-mass stars, what you get is an interaction between the proton and the electron. And as the proton has exhibits a force on the electron and changes its trajectory. So as it passes by the proton, the electron passes by the proton and it gets tweaked just a little bit in its trajectory. And so as it changes that direct trajectory a little bit, you release a photon. And so that is what's known as free-free emission, because both particles are free. And that will emit radiation towards these H2 regions or really high massive star forming sites. So some of the really beautiful images that you see of these nebula and H2 regions, the radio emission that you see in those images is this Bremsstrahlung emission. So those are the two main emission mechanisms that you can see at radio. Now, if you have a really bright, dusty cloud, sometimes you can get a little bit of dust continuum at the radio wavelengths, but a lot of those are going to be towards the microwave side, or a little bit of the higher frequency side of the radio part of the electromagnetic spectrum.
All right. So if I'm thinking about where are environments that I have those conditions, where I have things like lots of energy and ionized electrons, but also dust and neutral material, I start thinking of, all right, well, you already mentioned star-forming regions, because that's going to take most of the matter in the universe, which is hydrogen atoms. Even today, all these billions of years after the Big Bang, over 90% of the atoms in the universe that still remain are hydrogen atoms by number. So we have a lot of hydrogen atoms, and it's very easy to make neutral hydrogen. But I'm also thinking any of these really high energy phenomena, like if I have a black hole that's actively feeding, or a black hole that's siphoning mass off of a companion, or a star that's recently gone supernova, I would expect, you know, I'm also going to have those same conditions. And so I'd expect, you know, can I also see some of these interesting radio features around these objects as well?
Oh, absolutely. One of the brightest radio sources in the center of the galaxy is a source that's known as Sagittarius A star, named because of the constellation that it's found in, Sagittarius, and A star because it is the brightest radio source. But this is the supermassive black hole in the center of our galaxy. And it is one of the brightest radio emitters in the center region of the galaxy, one of the first radio sources that was ever detected. So absolutely, you can see these really bright radio emitters, you know, associated with black holes or accreting matter or pulsars. So as you have a spinning neutron star, you know, those emit really bright in the radio part of the spectrum. So there's a lot of different sources that you can see in the radio.
That's really fascinating. And also at the same time, I try and keep things in context for people. When we are looking in the radio, it's really similar to looking at optical wavelengths too, in the sense that we're only seeing a tiny fraction of all of the light that's coming from one of these objects, right? It's just that at these specific wavelengths, at these optical wavelengths, you're really good at seeing things like stars. At these radio wavelengths, we're really good at seeing things like energetic sources, ionized regions of gas, and and things like recent stellar cataclysms and actively feeding black holes. Are there things that most people might not think of as a good source for radio emissions, but that radio astronomy is actually really good at picking out?
Yeah. So one of the, I guess, big sources where you wouldn't really think of them as being emitters, and this is kind of a niche area for the Galactic Center. So in the center of the galaxy, we have these really large, I mean, these are, I guess they would be like 25 light years across. So these are very large structures in the center of the galaxy that are called non-thermal filaments. And they have only ever been seen in the center of our galaxy. And looking at these sources and the emission that we're seeing from them, which is synchrotron emission, it looks like what we are picking up are large magnetic fields in the center of the galaxy at these radio wavelengths that are really never seen, or we've never seen at the moment anywhere else in any other galaxy or even in our own galaxy. These are exclusive to the center of the galaxy, are these large threads of radio emission that are tracing just the magnetic fields in the center of the galaxy.
You know, that's a really fascinating topic. And I think it dovetails very nicely into something I was very excited to talk to you specifically about, which is a scientific endeavor called Fireplace, right? I know that if we talk about magnetic fields throughout the galaxy, right, not towards the galactic center, but just throughout the galaxy, we can measure that through a property called Faraday rotation, right? If I have light, just normal light, it's going to be polarized, right? But its polarization is going to be random, which is to say, like, the left-handed light and the right-handed light should come in equal amounts. If I were to take a polarizer and orient it in any specific direction, I would find that there's roughly the same amount of light polarized in all directions. But there's this property called Faraday rotation, where if I have magnetic fields that are in a region that light is passing through, that's going to induce a polarization in the light. And the strength of the polarization and the amount that the polarization rotates, that's called Faraday rotation, and that tells me what the magnetic fields are throughout the galaxy. And most galaxies, including our own, most of the galaxy is kind of boring. It has roughly these micro-Gauss-level magnetic fields, which is like 1/1,000,000th of what it is at the surface of Earth. And these fields are only coherent on scales of maybe a few hundred light years before they change directions. But if I start looking at the galactic center, I see something very different. I know that we have denser clouds towards the center of the galaxy than we do in most other places in the galaxy. I know that they're close together, and I know that their magnetic fields are measured to be stronger, maybe even hundreds of times stronger than they are, you know, in the more mundane regions of the galaxy. So what are we learning, or what is rather the purpose of this Fireplace survey that's going to probe the galactic center and these intense regions of magnetization a little more profoundly?
Yeah, so the Fireplace survey, just to go over a brief overview of what the survey is, the Fireplace survey is a survey, a dust polarization survey. So that means that we are studying the polarization of light that we see at infrared wavelengths. So this is typically wavelengths that you observe with telescopes like the SOFIA telescope, which was run by NASA and is the telescope that we had used for this project. So you're looking at the dust grains that are polarized in a specific direction. And so the light that we're seeing at infrared wavelengths is polarized as well. And so what we end up observing is we are looking at several of the dust clouds across the entire center of the galaxy. And we are making these measurements of what is the polarized light that we're measuring look like in these different dust clouds. And so one of the things that we have to do is we make the assumption that these dust grains are aligned with the magnetic fields. So that is something that has been thoroughly kind of established in the literature for the past several decades. But it is something that we are upfront about, that we are making these measurements in polarized light and with the assumption that the dust grains are aligned with the magnetic fields that are threading these different clouds. And so what we're doing is we're using them to gain an understanding on the direction of the magnetic field. And then using a couple calculations, we can infer what the magnetic field strength is, as well as what fraction of the light that we're seeing is polarized. So if you have a really strong radiative source that maybe is helping align the magnetic fields, or maybe you have a strong magnetic field and you have well alignment, you can end up getting really high fractional polarization with, you know, maybe even up to 10 to 20% of the light that you're seeing, infrared light that you're seeing from these sources, is polarized, which is a very, very strong number. Typically, what you would see is maybe about 1% of the light that you're observing is fractionally polarized. But towards some of these sources, we're seeing very strong or very high fractional polarization and relatively strong magnetic fields. So both at radio wavelengths and at infrared wavelengths, when we've made these measurements of what the magnetic field strength is, we've observed that it's on the order of about 100 times higher than what we observe in other regions of the Milky Way galaxy. And typically, the only other places where you really see this really high or strong magnetic field strengths is towards star-forming sites. So star-forming sites where you have a lot of gas that's collapsing down and forming these natal stars, you tend to see a lot of somewhat similar properties to where we see in the center of the galaxy. So you see the higher densities, you see the stronger magnetic fields, you see the higher temperatures. However, a lot of these star-forming sites are maybe a couple parsecs, so they're kind of confined to individual star-forming sites, whereas in the center of the galaxy, we're seeing these properties across hundreds of parsecs. So it's a very, very extreme environment. When you look at that compared with other regions of the Milky Way galaxy, and one of the only other regions where we tend to see this besides, star-forming sites in the Milky Way is in high redshift galaxies. So this is redshifts around 2 to 3, which is when you saw, or when we measure a peak in star formation across the entire universe, we see very similar properties to what we see in the center of the galaxy. So the center of the galaxy is almost thought to be an analog to these high redshift galaxies, where you can start to measure the properties and really see what goes on to cause the dynamics that we see in this region on cloud sizes or on individual protostars or really compact high resolution sites that you really can't see towards these distant galaxies, where you might just have a single, you know, pixel detection, or you might just have, a single galaxy that you can see, and you really can't see a lot of the individual clouds or, star formation sites in those distant galaxies. And so in the center of the galaxy, we can do really high resolution, really, really interesting, observations of these different clouds, where you can start to see, where these properties are starting to come from. And that's really kind of the one of the driving factors of why we really want to study the center of the galaxy. Is it's so unusual compared to anything else in the Milky Way. And the only other analogs that we see are either small star-forming sites, really massive star-forming sites in the Milky Way, and in high redshift galaxies. So the center of the galaxy is really unusual, and really we could start to study leading areas of physics.
You know, I think this is really fascinating. You brought up two things that I want to talk a little bit further about. The second one that I'll come back to is what's actually in sort of that central, I guess if I went right to the center of the galaxy at Sagittarius A star, and I drew like a circle around it that was about a degree in radius, there's interesting stuff in there. And I want to come back to that. But before we get to that, I want to ask you, we've been talking about radio, and now we're talking about the far infrared. And you brought up ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter/Submillimeter Array. And I'm a little bit, I'm a little bit unclear on the border of where does the far infrared end, right? We know that the near infrared begins where red light ends, at about 700 nanometers or 7,000 angstroms, if you prefer. And then we go out to about 5 microns, and that's the end of the near infrared, and then the mid infrared starts. And by the time you get up to about, 70 microns, you're in the far infrared. But by time you start talking about millimeter or centimeter wavelengths, now you're well into the radio. So where does the far infrared end, and where does the radio begin, and where does microwave come into play? Or are these kind of like, these are kind of iffy things, if you even want to categorize them? The important thing is these are long wavelengths where we can make interesting observations at.
Yeah, it's a bit more fluid as you go to the longer wavelengths. There really isn't a definitive kind of edge to the infrared. A lot of people, it depends on who you ask. like some people will say, oh, it ends at, 500 microns, whereas someone might say, oh, well, actually it goes all the way up to like 800 microns. But the order of, the different parts of the ENM spectrum. So radio is the longest wavelength. So you typically have radio wavelengths around a meter to maybe a centimeter in the wavelength numbers. And then after that, you have the microwave. And that's pretty much where you start to get to the millimeter part of the spectrum. So maybe about 1 millimeter, 3 millimeters, that's typically part of the microwave part of the spectrum. And then you move into the micron part of the spectrum, which is anything that's less than a millimeter. And when you start to get into that regime is when you start to get into the far infrared. But there's no real definitive, edge to any of these different parts of the spectrum, mainly just because a lot of the emission that you're seeing at these different wavelengths ranges or can vary across the whole entire spectrum. So for example, with dust is thought to be primarily emitting in the infrared. However, you can see emission from dust all the way down to 3 millimeters, down to some of these longer wavelengths, and it will go all the way up to the mid-infrared. So there's really no kind of definitive cutoff between the infrared and then the microwave and the microwave and the radio part of the spectrum. It's a little bit more fluid, which is why in the radio astronomy community, a lot of times what we'll talk about is either in wavelength. We're taking observations at 3 millimeters or something, or you might refer to them in gigahertz, which is the main or a large portion of the radio spectrum. So the 3 millimeters would be about 90 gigahertz at those wavelengths. So a lot of times, it is pretty fluid between the different parts of the ENM spectrum, mainly just because a lot of the emission that we're seeing can, vary or span several of these different regimes of the ENM spectrum. So there's really no significant cutoff or primary cutoff between the different parts of the spectrum.
Is it maybe fair to think about, all of these long wavelengths, the way we think about the cones in our eyes, that we have three different types of cones, or most of us have three different types of cones in our eyes, where one is more sensitive to blue light, one is more sensitive to green and yellow light, and one is more sensitive to red light. And our brains interpret that combined information as color. Is it kind of fair to think about, look, you can do the same thing with any three different sets of wavelengths of light, and it doesn't really matter if they're all in the radio or some in the microwave in the radio and some in the far infrared in the radio, that if you have three different wavelengths where one is shorter, one is intermediate, and one is longer, you can kind of assign different colors to the different wavelengths and use that to sort of create a composite image. I'm asking this because I don't want people to come away confused, because Natalie, you're a radio astronomer working at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, but you're doing a fireplace survey in the far infrared. How does that work? And the answer is, these long wavelengths are interesting to astronomers for what they encode, and whether you're doing far infrared or whether you're doing radio is really just dependent on what types of instruments and observatories are you using to make these observations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that, you know, as astronomers that we have to keep in mind is that a lot of these sources that we're seeing don't just emit in a single wavelength or even a single part of the E&M spectrum. You can see a lot of these sources that we observe in the center of the galaxy will emit at different wavelengths. And so if you're only looking at a single, you know, part of your spectrum, you're missing out on a whole lot of different information. You know, information that could help you address the science question that you're aiming to address in your paper or in your research project. And so being able to use multi-wavelength analysis can really help understand or paint a bigger picture on what your source is, what it's doing, and why it's doing that. And so I think you really need to have multi-wavelength astronomy to really understand that. And radio takes a whole, you know, it sets up a whole wealth of information that we can observe. Like I was mentioning, the synchrotron emission, the Bremsstrahlung emission, a lot of these different emission mechanisms are only observable at radio wavelengths. Pulsars primarily are observed with radio wavelengths. We would have no idea about pulsars if we hadn't really looked at these radio wavelengths. And so to only focus on a single part of the spectrum, you're missing out on so much different information that can really tell you a lot about what your source is doing. And I think you raised a good analogy there where you were talking about the different rods and cones and how, you know, some of them will look at blue and some of them will look at red. And that's pretty much what we're doing. You know, you might take an observation of your source maybe at 1 centimeter, maybe 3 centimeters, and then maybe, 2 millimeters or something. And so each of those are looking almost at a different color in your spectrum and can tell you a lot about your different sources. So one of the primary or one of the big things that you can do with this is a lot of these different clouds, dust clouds, can vary in their spectrum depending on their temperature. So if you have a really hot dust cloud, so maybe this dust cloud is surrounding a, protostar, and so you have a really lot of, or you have a lot of photons that are coming out and heating the dust that's around this protostar, then it might show up at the shorter wavelengths when you get closer to the near infrared. And so your spectrum will be shifted to shorter wavelengths, whereas you might have a cooler envelope, and then that would have where you're not really getting a whole lot of photons. And so that would be emitting more at the longer wavelengths. And so being able to take observations at different wavelengths can really tell you a lot about what your source is doing, even across your source itself. So it's not just, I'm looking at a pulsar, I need to look at, the specific wavelength. A lot of times what you can do is you can take observations across many wavelengths, and it can tell you a lot about what your source is doing and how it could be impacting the environment that's around it.
So if I start looking at the galactic center, I see, at the very center of the galaxy is Sagittarius A star, the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. If I look invisible wavelengths of light, I can't see it at all because the dust blocks my view there and I can't see it. If I look in the near infrared, I can see clear through to the galactic center. Nothing is really polluting my view, and I can actually track the individual stars that orbit around this point of darkness that I can't see anything there that I know corresponds to the supermassive black hole. But as I go to longer and longer wavelengths, right, if I get into the far infrared, I see there is emission coming from there. And in fact, there's quite a lot. But there's even more radio emission coming from that region, not just from the center itself, which is incredibly bright in the radio, but also from the region surrounding it. I see that there's radio emission coming for a large region around that black hole. I also see that there are tendril-like arcs that surround this supermassive black hole, including relatively far away from it, corresponding to distances of like tens or hundreds of light years from it. If I move a little bit towards the galactic east, towards the east of Sagittarius A star as viewed from, you know, in galactic coordinates, I can move and I can see there's a giant radio arc to the east of Sagittarius A star. And if I keep going a little further, I see that there's another very bright region called Sagittarius B2, a star-forming region. But Sagittarius B2, even though it's incredibly bright in the far infrared, it has very little radio emissions. It has some, but much, much less than Sagittarius A star. And so I'm curious, when we look in these different wavelengths of light at these different astrophysical phenomena that are present, is this like seeing just like, oh, well, it's like Sagittarius A star is a very red colored thing because it appears in the radio even brighter than it appears in the far infrared, and Sagittarius B2 would be a different colored thing because different wavelengths of light, in this case the far infrared rather than the radio, is more sensitive to the type of light found there. Is that what's going on in these different regions of the galaxy, that we're seeing different astrophysical objects and phenomena that correspond to different wavelengths that I'm sensitive to?
Yeah, so most of the emission that you're seeing from the supermassive black hole, you see a ton of radio emission that's coming from the compact source, that is the emission from Sagittarius A star. So we do see this spiral-like structure that's around the supermassive black hole that's maybe, it's about a couple parsecs, so that would be, you know, maybe 5 to 10 or so light years across. And this structure is known as the circumnuclear disk. And so it's this, or the mini spiral. And so it's thought to be features of gas and dust. So it's pretty bright in some of the longer far infrared wavelengths, and a little bit in some of the bremsstrahlung emission. So meaning that you see a lot of highly energetic protons and neutrons that are spiraling and interacting with each other towards this source. And when you look, however, at Sag B2, which is this star-forming site, it is one of the massive star-forming sites in the entire galaxy. There's really nothing else that's like it. So it's one of the more intense star-forming sites in the entire Milky Way galaxy. And there's just, it's two completely almost different environments. So you've got the supermassive black hole, you've got kind of a mini spiral of gas that is thought to be interacting with the, you know, gravitational potential that's right at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, right at the very center of the galaxy. Whereas when you're looking at Sag B2, you're seeing dozens and dozens and dozens of protostars that are being formed. You see high extinction towards you know, this region, even at radio wavelengths, just because there is a really dense region of where these stars are being formed. You see a lot of absorption towards this region as well. And there's almost this running joke in the Galactic Center community where it's like, okay, any molecule that you want to find, you know, you look at Sag B2 first because it's probably going to be there. It's just really molecularly rich. We've seen, you know, these really complex carbon chain of molecules. And so there's just a, you know, they're almost completely different environments, but they're both observable at radio wavelengths. So you can really kind of see, you know, how, you know, versatile radio astronomy is, just because, you know, you take a picture of the center of the galaxy and you're able to see two completely different types of phenomena that are going on towards this inner region.
Well, let me ask you, I hear this term in radio astronomy circles that I don't hear anywhere else, that they call the region surrounding that cloud, Sagittarius B2, I believe they call it the CMZ, or the central molecular zone. Is that what you're talking about? That, you know, pretty much you can imagine a molecule made out of the atoms we have there. This is where you look for it. Why is there a CMZ at all in this region of the galaxy?
Yeah, so the CMZ is almost kind of a subset of the Galactic Center. So you have the Galactic Center, which is thought to be the inner 200 to maybe 500 parsecs of the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And in the Galactic Center, where you have, you know, pulsars, you have a stellar population, you have, stellar clusters, you have the supermassive black hole, you also have a large population or a large mass of molecular gas. And now this molecular gas is oriented in what looks to almost be an infinity-like shape. So if you look up pictures of the central molecular zone or the CMZ at infrared wavelengths or towards dust or molecules, you'll see this kind of twisted like ring structure. And so that is the central molecular zone. So the SAGB2 complex or the SAGB2 cloud is part of this larger structure. But it's much larger than just SAGB2. So it's about, it's about 100 to maybe 200 parsecs across, and you pretty much have this supermassive black hole kind of at the center of this ring of molecular gas and dust that's orbiting around the center of the galaxy, where you can have, you know, star-forming sites and potentially feedback from these other clouds and just a lot of different types of energetic phenomena going on.
Well, that's really fascinating. I mean, that we have this giant complex of dust and complex molecules in our galactic center. And what you talked about at this past January's AAS meeting, American Astronomical Society meeting, was a feature that I think was even a little bit farther to the east than Sagittarius B2 is away from the galactic center. And you identified what I believe looks kind of like a remnant of an exploded star, like one of those supernova remnants that might still be present from a relatively recent explosion. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found and why it's so interesting?
Yeah. So it's this cloud. Yes. Yeah, so it's a little bit further out away from SAGB2 and the supermassive black hole of the center. But we still believe that it's located in the center of the galaxy. When you look at it at dust wavelengths, it almost has this kind of donut-like shape where you've got a hole at the center and then you kind of see this thick disk around, you know, that's forming in the cloud. And so when we looked at the gas kinematics, so this is looking at velocities using molecules to study what the gas or the dust is doing or how it's moving, what we see is it almost looks like there's this expansion. So there's something that's went off or is powering this expansion outwards, where you have the cloud is basically moving and getting larger and expanding outwards from this central source. And so some previous observations and previous work that was done on this source argued that the only type of phenomena that could produce this expansion or produce the speeds that they're detecting or that they're measuring in their observations was a supernova remnant. So basically you had some massive star that underwent a supernova and ejected material out in every direction. And so you have this expanding shell where it's pushing out the gas and dust, collecting the gas and dust as it's radiating outwards. And so what we had ended up finding in our fireplace survey, so this was, again, looking at the magnetic fields, looking at, you know, their orientation and their strength. And so what we ended up finding when we looked at the source was that the magnetic fields seemed to follow that curvature around this source. So it almost seems to be as if you had the expansion, you have the gas moving out, and as it's collecting that gas and dust, it's also collecting the magnetic fields that are threaded throughout the cloud. And so as it's collecting those magnetic fields and sweeping them up as it's radiating outwards and collecting more and more and more of the magnetic fields that are in the region around it, that's causing the magnetic field strength to go up as well. And we saw that when we looked at our source across different radii. So, you know, if you you know, put a center, you put an annulus around your source, and you look at the magnetic field strength at different radii, what we ended up finding is that, you know, we see this peak in our magnetic field strength, or we see this increase in the magnetic field strength that corresponds to the center of where the annulus or where the donut is located. So it seems to increase, and then we see this almost gradual decrease as we're getting back into the ambient medium or the ambient magnetic fields. So in our recent paper, what we argue is that the expansion is causing this gas and dust and magnetic fields to be swept up, and we're seeing this field enhancement that's due to this feedback from this evolved massive star that underwent a supernova.
And I think this is really compelling, right? Because I know that you don't measure the magnetic field directly. What you measure is the polarization of light. You can measure both its direction and the strength of the polarization. And you sort of see this peak in polarization happening, you know, I won't say it's like uniformly in a ring, but it seems like it's in multiple, I guess, hot spots located in a relatively ring-like shape. And this makes sense to me because what I know of magnetic fields is that originally, you know, if you have, you know, a medium that has a magnetic field in it, things are going to get magnetized in that direction. But then if you go and say, okay, now we're going to have some other kind of force distort the matter that's magnetized in here, those magnetic field lines are generally not going to break and reconnect. What's going to happen in the more general case is those field lines, as you move the matter around, those field lines are going to get bunched up and compressed together. So it kind of makes sense to me if you're saying, okay, we had some background magnetic field, but then some sort of, you know, cataclysm happened, and the material that was magnetized is now all pushed out in sort of a sphere from this central region. Well, I would imagine, well, all of that material that was magnetized before is now going to be magnetized more strongly because it got compressed into this thin ring-like shape. And when I saw from your research something that looked extremely consistent with that, I was like, that is a really cool picture. And is that something that just leapt out at you right away as well?
Oh, absolutely. Once we had our first data reduction and we had our first images, it just was striking to see that type of circular like nature in this source. There really wasn't anything else in any of the sources in the galactic center that had this type of signature, and has really almost started this conversation within the galactic center community about understanding this source. It was kind of almost overlooked. It had been in a couple, you know, previous papers. You know, it is somewhat close to SAGB-2, you know, maybe within like 15 to 20 or so parsecs. And so people who've looked at SAGB-2, you know, maybe had this source kind of included in some of their observations, but it was almost kind of tucked to the side. It really hadn't, you know, had a whole lot of momentum or, you know, just interest really until these results came out and we saw what the magnetic field was doing. And that's almost caused this kind of increase in our interest in this source. You know, it was kind of a spurious result. We hadn't really expected to see this here. You know, a lot of times when you're looking towards this region of the galaxy, everyone always wants to look at SAGB-2, but there's a lot of other interesting sources, and this is one of them. And I'm glad that we had ended up wanting to go a little bit further out in our coverage of the entire galactic center. It's kind of a little bit on the edge of where our map was, but I'm glad that we ended up going this direction because we found this really interesting source and has started this almost discussion on, you know, how does feedback of, you know, these massive stars and, you know, evolved massive stars, what are their effects on the magnetic fields in this region or in the center of the galaxy? And so, you know, this is kind of starting a conversation on looking at some other potential sources in our survey. So we currently have the first data releases out. It was accepted for publication back in December. The second, Fireplace 2, which focuses on this source, the paper is currently on archive. And we're currently in discussions with the referee on finalizing some of their final comments on it before it's published. And then we have this Fireplace 3, which is one of the other postdocs that's working on this project, Dylan Perry, who is taking the reins on that, where we are presenting the full data release survey. And there are just so many interesting sources in here that we're hoping to follow up on to see if they also have been overlooked. And so this is really kind of a novel result that really hasn't been done for this region before. A lot of the previous polarization surveys of the Galactic Center targeted a few clouds, so like SAGE-B2, you know, the circumnuclear disk around Sag A star, and a couple other, you know, prominent sources in the Galactic Center, but nothing on the scale of doing this large survey across the entire CMZ. So this is a really novel survey of the center of the galaxy that just hasn't been done before. And so a lot of these, you know, interesting sources may have been overlooked previously, but when you look at the dust polarization or you look at the magnetic fields in them, you know, they're really striking. You know, there's a couple other sources where we see one where it almost looks as if the magnetic field is curved, as if a source is being ejected from the center of the galaxy that we want to follow up on. You know, there's a couple other ones where we're seeing, you know, edges of some of these really large bubbles in the center of the galaxy, or potentially interactions between those non-thermal filaments that I had talked about previously, and looking to see if any of those could be threading through some of these molecular clouds and could be interacting with them. So there's really just a ton of wealth of information that we can get from a survey of this size that just hasn't been done before. So we're kind of on the precipice of understanding how the magnetic fields within these clouds could be shaping them, or could be you know, influencing their structure, or how the clouds themselves could be interacting with the magnetic field, or shaping the magnetic field, or dragging the magnetic fields as they're orbiting. So really, there's just so much information that we can understand, you know, using the survey. And we are just now, we just posted, I guess, early last month, Fireplace 3, which shows this full survey of the magnetic fields in the center of the galaxy. And right now we're going through and doing a fine-tooth comb of, you know, checking out these different interesting clouds and seeing what they can tell us about the magnetic fields in this region.
I mean, this is so fascinating to me. And just to give people at home an impression of the scales we're talking about, when Natalie is talking about we're covering a huge range of the galactic center, this magnetized dust ring that she found is a whopping 0.8 degrees away from the actual physical center of the galaxy. And this big dusty ring that she found is actually very large in astronomy terms. It's about 30 light years in diameter. It's about, 5 parsecs in radius, around 30 light years in diameter, which is really big. Like the recent supernova remnants that we see today, they've expanded to maybe be about 5 to 10 light years in diameter. So a 30 light year diameter one is very, very big. But all of that said, other people have looked at this region before. Other people have even made radio and far infrared maps of this region before. But they weren't able to find a feature like this. Can I ask you if it was like the instruments you were using that allowed you to find this feature, or if it was the fact that you were mapping things out with an intent to reveal certain features that allowed this magnetized dust ring to be found?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, actually. So one, a lot of the previous observations were single pointing. And you can cut this if you need to, but they were single pointings, and they used this mode that was called chop nod, which is where you point on your source and then you point off your source and you're kind of going back and forth between on and off. And so they weren't doing these large surveys or like mapping or scanning across the center of the galaxy. They were looking at targeted clouds. So they might be looking at SAGE-B2, or they might be looking at SAGE-C, or they might be looking at like a specific cloud in general. And that was really what the target of their observations were. So it was a little bit of a spurious result, but part of it was the strategy that we were using. So we went into this observing strategy where we said we want to do a magnetic field survey of the entire galactic center. So what we ended up doing, instead of doing this chop nod or doing this on-off pointing observing strategy, we did this scanning strategy. So that's where you basically take your telescope and you just scan across the entire coverage of the CMZ back and forth, and you're just constantly taking observations as you're moving the telescope, rather than doing a point and focus, take a snapshot, then take a snapshot off, and you're going back and forth. With that, what we were doing just constant scanning across the center of the galaxy. And because we use this novel observing method, we were able to target a large coverage of the entire CMZ compared to these previous observations, which only took single snapshots of individual clouds in the center of the galaxy. So to answer your question, it's a little bit of both. It was part of the strategy that we did where we were able to cover the entire center of the galaxy. And part of it was just, the source itself was interesting. And, maybe if someone else had already, done the targeted survey on this source, they probably would have seen the same thing, even if they looked at different wavelengths, different infrared wavelengths. But since we had covered a large coverage of the entire galactic center, we were able to pick up on these really interesting sources that kind of popped up only when we looked at them with the dust polarization. The source that we covered has been included in 20 other surveys, ranging from, all the way at far radio wavelengths down to, 90 centimeters, all the way up to X-ray. When we were investigating the source to really understand its nature, we did a deep dive into some of the previous surveys of the galactic center, and the source has been covered dozens of times. But it was really once we looked at the magnetic fields that we understood how striking the source actually was. It's been picked up in a lot of the infrared wavelengths, which is, what we observed in our survey. We see a little bit in radio, which almost looks to be in some of the far radio wavelengths. There's a couple interesting sources in X-rays that are nearby. It's an infrared dark cloud, which means that we see it obscured at the near infrared wavelength. So the source has been covered, but it's really once we looked at the dust polarization and we saw what the magnetic fields were doing that it really became striking. And this isn't the only source in our survey that's, particularly interesting. There's several other sources that we want to follow up on, which also show this kind of unusual like behavior in the magnetic fields, or show some interesting type of morphology or orientation in the magnetic field directions that we went to investigate further. And that was really one of the big takeaways with this survey that just hasn't been done, is because people hadn't looked at it with dust polarization. A lot of it had just been done in other general surveys of infrared wavelengths or continuum observations or molecular gas. But it was when we looked at it in the dust polarization that it became striking, and has started a conversation within the galactic center community on investigating some of these other sources or doing follow-up observations to really understand the nature of this source and, what is producing the expansion. That is still an unknown question. In our paper, we covered a couple, potential candidates that we argue for, but since the focus of our paper was on the magnetic fields and the magnetic field strength, we introduced these sources as potential candidates, but that's something that we want to do in a follow-up publication, would be to investigate these different sources and really understand, well, what produced the expansion? Do we see the remnant of what had caused the expansion for this source. So I think there's still tons of open questions that are left to answer about this. And this dust polarization study, kind of started that conversation. And it looks like it's going to start the conversation for several other sources in the Galactic Center as well.
You know, I love this story because to me, it's a great detective story of some type of, sometimes people ask me, what's the difference between an astronomer and an astrophysicist? And I generally say, like, well, the astronomers are the people who go out and they look for the things and they identify them and they measure and they characterize them. And the astrophysicists are the people who try and come up with the underlying explanation of what are the mechanisms and phenomena that could cause the things that we're seeing. And of course, most people who do astronomy are also astrophysicists, and most people who do astrophysics are very interested in the astronomical observations. And it sounds like, you know, for you, there's no dividing line at all. Obviously, you're both and you're doing both. But what I wanted to ask is, in terms of galactic archaeology, you know, we've only seen our most recent supernova with the naked eye in our Milky Way in 1604, but we know that several others have occurred. We know that Cassiopeia A went off sometimes towards the end of the 17th century. Even though no one on Earth saw it, it's the brightest radio source beyond the solar system in the entire sky, and it's a relatively recent supernova remnant. We know, I think, G plus 1.9 minus 0.3, I think its phone number is a supernova remnant from about 150 years ago towards the galactic center. And this ring you've identified, which I think has the phone number of M 0.8 minus 0.2, that's now another candidate supernova remnant. And I'm really curious, you know, by looking with this new technique, not that it's a new technique, but that we haven't applied it to this until recently, of dust polarization, are we able to identify possible, we're finding these objects, these rings, these remnants that may have come from a stellar cataclysm? And is this going to change our understanding of how we think frequent supernova are in the galactic center, where they form in the galactic center, their relationship to star-forming regions, how they carve cavities in the gas and dust that's present? It seems like a lot of different astronomers and astrophysicists who were maybe from a different set of communities, not necessarily from a galactic center community, are going to be interested in these results.
Yeah. So when we're looking, I guess, for other supernova remnants, really the key takeaway with those, and one of the ways that we really determine if these are supernova remnants, is using a technique that's called, what you're doing is you're doing almost a momentum calculation. So you're looking at basically how much energy, how much feedback you need to drive these sources, because you can get a lot of different other types of feedback. It's not just supernova remnants that you can get in the galactic center. You can get feedback from massive stars or from massive clusters of stars. And so feedback where you have some type of central source that is just pushing gas away, you can have multiple different phenomena that are caused by that. And so the way that you can determine if feedback is caused by, you know, massive stars or, you know, winds from massive stars or radiation versus having, you know, an ejected material from, a star that's ended or, you know, reached the end of its life, is by doing these momentum calculations where you say, okay, well, we know how much dust or how much gas or how much mass is in this bubble or is in this shell. And you can look then at the velocity, so basically at its expansion, and you can say, okay, well, I know how much energy I needed in that expansion in order, or at the, when your source goes off or when you have this kind of detonation, how much energy you need from that detonation in order to produce that expansion of how much mass is being swept up. So a lot of these different sources, when we're trying to look and determine what caused them, if it is winds from massive stars or if it's caused by a supernova remnant, is by doing that momentum calculation where you can say, okay, well, you would need, at least three supernova that go off to produce this expansion, or you'd need at least a supernova to go off to produce this expansion. Whereas, winds might be a little bit less energetic when you have just winds that are coming off of these massive stars, the same way you have winds that come off of the sun. Whereas a supernova remnant has a whole lot more energy that's being released. And so in order to determine, since, like you said, we always see are just snapshots out in space. So you might see a ring out in space, you might see this bubble out in space, but the way that you determine if it was caused by a supernova or if it was caused by just winds from a stellar cluster is by doing this momentum calculation. However, when we look with the dust polarization and you're looking for these ring-like structures, they can identify places that you want to do these calculations for, where you see this ring-like structure and you're like, oh, that's an interesting source. Well, let me go and look at that with a molecular line survey to see what its expansion is, or how much dust or mass is associated with that source. And then you can identify, okay, well, clearly you would need at least two or three supernova to go off in order to produce that expansion. So I think, being able to have these polarization observations, they really kind of highlight one, where these interesting sources are, and two, how magnetic fields might be influencing them. If you have a magnetic field that's, in threaded throughout your clouds, those could be resistant to this expansion. And so you might need a little bit more energy in order to overcome that or push those magnetic fields away. And so a lot of times in a lot of the MHD simulations or a lot of, these different types of simulations that we make of the galactic center, magnetic fields tend to get overlooked a little bit, mainly just because they're a little bit complicated. And sometimes, it's a higher order term that you might include in your calculations. But one of the things that we found with this source is that, they can really show you what the magnetic fields are doing and start to give insight on how important or how much of an effect the magnetic fields might be playing on the structures of these clouds, the feedback on these clouds, and could be hindering or helping star formation that we see in these clouds. So really, it was almost this kind of, unknown type of, feature that we needed to know in order to better understand the center of the galaxy.
This is wonderful because it makes me very hopeful, but it also makes me a little concerned, and I wanna tell you about this and get your reaction to it. It makes me very hopeful because in terms of galactic archaeology, right, this is one tool we have, right? Dust polarization mapping is one tool that we can use, and it is in many areas of astronomy. You say, okay, we have this tool, and this tool is great at identifying certain features. And these features aren't necessarily completely unambiguous, right? There could be multiple things that cause them, but we can identify candidates for either supernovae or star-forming regions, or maybe other exotic forms of things that inject energy and create winds. And then by making further observations with other tools and techniques, we can sort of determine, well, what actually is this? So this is very useful for identifying features, telling you some details about them and also details about other things, and then saying, and if you want to follow this up, here are some great tools you can go ahead and follow it up with, which I think is wonderful. This is how astronomy should work, where certain types of observations occur and they motivate other types of follow-up observations that really allow you to learn more about the universe than you knew before. But the reason I'm concerned about this is I know that the facilities that you would love to use to make these observations at the highest precision and highest resolution and with the best accuracy possible are not necessarily available the way they were just a few short years ago. NASA's SOFIA, our best far infrared telescope, you can't have it be a ground-based telescope because you can't see the far infrared from the ground. it's very expensive to launch a large telescope up into space. And the downside of if you do that is it is stuck with whatever instruments were aboard it when you launched it. For me, NASA's SOFIA, the Stratospheric Observatory Far Infrared was really revolutionary because it was a plane-based far infrared observatory that you could basically fly it anywhere in the world at high altitudes above most of the atmosphere, and you could make observations of the far infrared universe from anywhere your plane could get to, at any time you wanted, at any location you wanted, and you could see a lot of things from those high altitudes. Then you had the bonus that you could come back down to the ground, and if you had a better instrument that you wanted to upgrade SOFIA with, that was as easy as doing it for any ground-based telescope. So we kind of had the best of all worlds. And very recently, NASA chose not to renew SOFIA, and I believe it's flown its last flight many months ago already, and it will no longer observe in the far infrared, and we have no plans for a telescope to replace it. We also have this issue that if you want to observe the radio at the highest resolutions and precisions possible, yes, it's great to have an array of good size radio dishes like the VLA or like ALMA, but for some purposes, you'd love to have a giant radio dish like the Arecibo Observatory. But when that telescope was damaged by Hurricane Maria and then later collapsed, it has been decommissioned and there's no plans to replace it. And I'm kind of wondering, wow, like, you have proven what types of high-quality science can be done with far-infrared astronomy, looking at the galactic center, and we know the incredible precisions we can get from a high-resolution radio observatory. And part of me is wondering, are these observatories a thing of our past, or is there a bright future ahead for radio, and I guess I'll include far infrared astronomy with that?
Yeah, you raise a good point. With the, I guess, closure of SOFIA, we did end up losing one of the really phenomenal instruments that we could use to do dust polarization or to study infrared wavelengths, towards different parts of the galaxy. So there are a couple other telescopes, though, that are coming on the horizon. So I'm going to name three. So one of them is called the TMT. So that's the there's a telescope that is being commissioned and developed in northern Mexico. It is a large single dish telescope that would operate at 1 millimeter. Which would have the capability of doing dust polarization. Now, the one downside with this one is the fact that because you're at 1 millimeter, or you're at kind of the microwave part of your spectrum, you might run into not just seeing dust polarization towards these sources, but possibly synchrotron emission. So you do kind of get this contamination a little bit if you're looking towards any of these dust continuum sources, where you might also see synchrotron emission, which could be influencing the measurements that you're making. So you do have to be aware of that. But that is something that is coming online and is a way to kind of almost salvage some of the far infrared or microwave polarization observations towards some of these sources. There's also this kind of push for an instrument that's called PRIMA, which is it wouldn't be, I guess, online, or even if it is funded, it wouldn't be online for about another decade or two. But that is something that is currently being developed or currently being, written up as a possible NASA probe that we would be sending up that would work at the far infrared or at the infrared wavelengths. So that is currently being It's not being commissioned, but we are currently in the process of setting up what specs we would need for that, possible instrument. And then we would have to go through the review. So NASA wants to have either some type of infrared or possibly X-ray probe that they would like to develop for a launch in the 2030s. So even if PRIMA is selected among all of the other candidates, that wouldn't be online for at least another decade or two. So that would be far, far future. But the NGVLA, so this would be a radio telescope that would operate at the same wavelengths as the VLA, or very similar wavelengths to the VLA, but would be a much larger instrument. So the way that radio telescopes work, or the way that radio interferometers work, is that the best resolution that you can get is based on your longest baseline. So what I mean by baseline is you have two antennas and the distance between them is your baseline. So the further apart you can put your antennas, the longer your baseline is, and therefore the highest angular resolution that you can see. So it's almost inverted. So the longer your baselines, the better angular resolution. The closer your baselines, the larger your angular resolution. So the NGVLA is going to be this large facility that is currently being developed by the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. And we are going to be placing telescopes all across North America. So there'll be a couple down in Mexico, there's going to be a couple down in Puerto Rico, and then all the way across, the United States, the continental United States. And so by covering a large portion of North America, we can make these really long baselines between these different antennas. And by having them work together, we can make just this really large telescope that covers the whole northern hemisphere. And be able to get really great angular resolution towards some of these star-forming sites, towards some of these different, compact sources, to be able to resolve them and see them in high detail on what they're doing, why they're the way that they are, and be able to see some of the really, fine features towards these sources. So that is something that's currently has been greenlit. We are currently working on prototypes for these dishes before implementing them over the next decade or two. So we need to build hundreds of these different antennas that we have to place all throughout North America. So this is something that we are currently working on for the NRAO community or radio astronomy community. It's going to be this really impressive instrument. So this is the NGVLA, or the next generation VLA, that's currently being commissioned, and we're hoping to have first light within the next decade or so.
I mean, that's a really wonderful set of things to be building and looking forward to. I think both the X-ray and far infrared communities have been, I will say, if you went and broke up all of the electromagnetic spectrum from gamma rays at the highest energy down to radio waves at the lowest energies, you can sort of look at the progression of sensitivity and resolution, and how much of the sky have we been able to cover with the tools we have. And I feel like X-ray and far infrared are by far the regions of the spectrum where, boy, we have really devoted so few resources to them compared to the other sets of wavelengths that are out there. In X-ray wavelengths, NASA's Chandra, which was launched last century, is still the most sensitive X-ray observatory that we have. As far as the far infrared, we had Herschel, I guess, in the aughts from the European Space Agency. And other than Herschel and SOFIA, we haven't really had anything that probes the far infrared this millennium. And so I'm really thinking, I hope something happens to serve those two communities particularly. But also when it comes to radio astronomy, I mean, something like the NGVLA would be an absolute game changer. If you look at what we can observe and what we're limited by, both in terms of light gathering power and in terms of resolution, something like the NGVLA would be an absolute game changer. Because right now, the VLA is wonderful, the Very Large Array is wonderful, but it's really at this point, what, 30 years old, more than 30 years old, even in its current incarnation. And when you compare it with something like ALMA, which was built, this century, ALMA is, it achieves much higher resolution, it's much more powerful, it can image much fainter sources, and I think you really want something at least as good as that in the northern hemisphere too, so you can observe the whole sky, which we can't do right now. Do you think like these are really essential projects if we want to push the frontiers of astronomy past where they are now?
Oh, absolutely. At the longer wavelengths in radio, so stuff that is covered with the VLA, even with them, so the VLA has four different array configurations that we can have it in, A through D, and A is the longest baselines, and even at the longest baselines, at our shortest wavelengths, you still really aren't able to resolve, really any, a lot of the H2 regions or some of these sources, whereas with the NGVLA, we are going to be able to see some of the protostars, so the formation of stars with their disks and accretion and colder clouds, some of the high resolution H2 regions or compact H2 regions. You really almost need the NGVLA in order to be able to see those sources or resolve those sources. And so I think being able to push those next capabilities and be able to develop, the technology and the instruments that we need to be able to, support that science. I think that's pushing almost the next frontier of, radio astronomy and being able to, have the working knowledge to have all of these different telescopes. I mean, we're having hundreds of these different antennas or hundreds of these different antennas working together and being able to handle those large data sets. So yeah, being able to have or handle all of these different antennas working together. So one, you run into, that these are just going to be large data sets. You have 100 different antenna that are each taking observations. So, each antenna has its own, computing resources that it needs to be able to handle those observations. And then being able to correlate each baseline together, again, is that next hurdle. So I think we're really pushing kind of the capabilities of both science and technology with some of these new facilities that are coming online. So the NGVLA, I think, is going to be this phenomenal instrument that we're going to be able to use for the next, 50 years again, just like what we've done with the VLA and then now starting with ALMA. The NGVLA is going to be that next step and is going to be able to resolve some of these really high resolution observations of, protostars, of high redshift galaxies, of, cosmology, of there's just a wide range of different science projects that the NGVLA we'll be able to address with this facility.
Can I ask you if there's anything really compelling that you hope to learn about the galactic center that one or more of these next generation observatories will finally enable, where there's something where you're like, oh, I want to know the answer to that, but our instruments just aren't good enough? Is there something that keeps you up at night that you think about, wow, if only we got to this point, then I'd be able to know the answer?
So one of the big things with the NGVLA is because you have all of these additional telescopes, you have what's known as a larger collecting area. So when you add up all of your different dishes, all of your tiny little dishes together, you're essentially creating a larger dish. And so you have a much larger collecting area. And so you could think of it almost as like a light bucket. So the larger your light bucket is and the more photons that you can collect, the better your sensitivity is. So one of the things that we want to do with our source that we had talked about earlier, so this bubble, is we would love to be able to understand what our line of sight magnetic field is towards the source and be able to paint this 3D picture of how the magnetic field is oriented in the source. So when we're looking at it with dust polarization, basically what we're all we're getting is plane of sky. So you're seeing how the magnetic fields are oriented along, you know, when you look at the source against the background sky. But now that doesn't mean that you're, you know, all of your magnetic fields are, you know, completely in line with the magnetic or with the background. You could be having some 3D orientation of those magnetic fields. So one of the things that we looked at when we were doing our survey work is that there is emission in the radio towards the source that has what looks to be synchrotron emission when we look at its spectral index. So that's basically where you make measurements across multiple wavelengths and you can see if it's arising, like if it's getting brighter or you know, at shorter wavelengths versus longer wavelengths, and that can tell you what your emission is. And so what we see is we see what looks to be synchrotron emission, which means that you have some type of magnetic field that's being interacting with the radio emission that we're observing. And so because of that, what we can do is we can make polarization observations at radio wavelengths. Now, however, since the radio emission that we're observing is already very, very faint, so these are observations that were taken with the Meerkat telescope down in the southern hemisphere, the emission that we're seeing at these radio wavelengths is already really, really faint. And in order to pick up, you know, a fractional polarization that is, you know, 1% or 1/100th of that already faint emission is just not really feasible at this moment. You know, we would need hundreds and hundreds of hours on the VLA at the moment in order to be able to make those measurements on what our line of sight magnetic field orientation is at the radio wavelengths. However, with the NGVLA, we would be able to do that in a couple hours. And so really being able to make those measurements is a lot more feasible or, you know, we're able to make those measurements using the NGVLA that we really can't with, you know, some of the current sensitivity limits that we have towards the galactic center, towards some of these fainter sources in the galactic center. So that's one of the things that I personally am looking forward to is being able to see some of the line of sight magnetic fields towards this source and some of the other potential interesting sources that we're currently investigating in the rest of the Fireplace survey. That's one of the things that we want to investigate. And then being able to do some of the really high resolution observations towards H1. So even so H1 is one of the longer wavelengths. It's 21 centimeters, then it's about 1.2 or so gigahertz. So this is considered to be part of the longer wavelengths, part of the radio spectrum. And so because you're at the longer wavelengths, your resolution gets a lot larger than if you're at shorter wavelengths. So it's kind of also inversely proportional. If you're at shorter wavelengths or higher frequency, your beam size is smaller than if you were looking at your source in the same array configuration at lower frequencies or longer wavelengths. And so since the H1 transition, which is neutral hydrogen, is at the longer part of the radio spectrum, that means that our beam size or our resolution is pretty coarse. So even when you go to these longer baselines, it's still relatively coarse. And so being able to look at neutral hydrogen towards some of these sources, and then again, being able to do absorption towards the neutral hydrogen or of the neutral hydrogen towards the center of the galaxy can really tell you a lot about how some of these clouds are interacting or really what your line of sight is towards different regions in the center of the galaxy. So one of the things that we run into with the center of the galaxy is line of sight arrangement or the 3D structure of these clouds. So Again, what we're seeing when we look at some of these sources, you're just seeing these sources against the plane of the sky. So you really have no 3D understanding of, you know, is this source in front or on the near side of the galactic center, or is it on the far side of the galactic center? You basically just see a snapshot across the entire center of the galaxy, and you have no 3D understanding. And that's really one of the big key questions in the CMZ community or in the galactic center community, is how all these different clouds that we observe in this central molecular zone or in the inner ring of the galactic center, how these are all interacting with each other. You know, if you see two clouds side by side, that does not necessarily mean that they are, you know, side by side in 3D space. You know, you could have one that's on the near side, and then the one next to it could be on the far side. You have no understanding, or really a lack of information on near side versus far side. Now, if you have a telescope like the NGVLA, where you can start to do some line of sight arrangement, where you're looking at different absorption versus emission mechanisms, you can start orienting these features relative to each other, where if you see an absorption feature in one cloud, but you don't see it in the cloud right next to it, then that might mean that your first cloud is actually on the backside of the galactic center, because you see an absorption feature, which means you have something in front of it. So I think there's a lot of different key science questions that we can address with the NGVLA. And it's not just doing high resolution observations of some of these sources, although those will make some fantastic pictures of the galactic center. But there's a lot of really interesting key science questions that are open right now that we can address using the NGVLA or even the wideband sensitivity upgrade that ALMA is undergoing at the moment as well. So I think there's a lot of different science questions that are open that we're hoping to address within the coming decade.
Well, thank you so much for laying that out for our listeners. I know a lot of times when people talk about next generation telescopes or bigger arrays or longer arrays or bigger dishes, that people just think, oh yeah, I guess that's how astronomy progresses. And they don't really think about what we're going to learn from this, what we're going to be able to do with this, what this is going to teach us about the universe, and how this is going to open up a new frontier and allow us to peer over the current horizon. So thank you so much for giving us a glimpse into what the radio and far infrared communities are looking for as we look out towards the future. Natalie, you've been an excellent guest, and I've been so lucky to have you. And before I let you go, do you have any final thoughts that you would like to share with our listeners out there?
Ooh. I mean, I guess the big questions, being able to understand the big questions, and really just the, you know, space is what is it, the next frontier, being able to understand, you know, our galaxy, I think is really just the forefront of being able to understand, you know, where we've been, where we're going. And there's just so much to, so many different parts of astronomy. And a lot of people tend to look at, you know, astronomy as, you know, either stuff in this, you know, that's local, like solar system, or look at, you know, the Big Bang, or, you know, the early universe. And there's just so much more to astronomy than just, you know, the key highlights. And being able to understand the center of the galaxy is really one of the more interesting places, in my opinion, of the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, you see all of these different clouds that are compacted together, you know, they're compressed down into this like small region in this in the galaxy itself, but there's just so much going on. And being able to resolve and be able to study these different clouds and understand them can really then understand our, you know, our understanding of, you know, gravity. You know, you've got a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. You've got stuff that's orbiting around it. And you can see, you know, the effects of how, you know, gravity will affect, you know, feedback or affect these different clouds and affect, you know, this inner region of the galaxy. So, you know, astronomy, there's just so much that goes into it. And I guess if we have any listeners who are, you know, either amateur astronomers or students who maybe are interested in astronomy, there's just so many different
areas of astronomy that you could venture into. You know, you've got high redshift galaxies, you've got cosmology, you've got solar system, you've got the sun, you've got, you know, galaxies in general, you've got exoplanets. So there's just a wide range of just different areas of astronomy that you can venture into. And for me personally, I think being able to study the center of the galaxy is just one of the, you know, really interesting places in the Milky Way that you just don't see anywhere else in the Milky Way galaxy. It's really unique. And you've got a lot of just different things that are going on. And a lot of, you know, it, you know, ties to other parts of the galaxy. So, for example, like looking at, you know, interactions between, you know, the galactic center and then the Fermi bubbles. So you have the Fermi bubbles, which are, you know, oriented above and below the galactic plane. And those are thought to be, you know, funneling or, you know, being produced by material that's being funneled out of the center of the galaxy as a giant chimney. So there's just so many different interesting things that you can tie back to the center of the galaxy. And I just love being able to study some of these really cool clouds and really interesting sources in there. And I'm hoping that with the Fireplace Survey, we'll be able to find dozens more of these really interesting sources and start the conversation on those for follow-up.
You know, thank you so much, Natalie, for telling us about that and also for everything we've talked about today. This has been a wonderful exploration of a part of the universe that maybe doesn't get as much attention from the media as other aspects, but it's no less interesting. And it's another way of peeling back the boundaries of the frontier of our cosmic understanding. So thanks to you, Natalie Butterfield, and thanks to all of you out there for tuning in and listening to us. The Starts With a Bang podcast is only made possible through the generous donation of our Patreon supporters, and I'd like to thank everyone who supports us at the $5 a month level and above. Thanks go to Chad Marler, Jeff Bonwick, Lainey Chewist, Rob Hansen, Samir Kumar, Tim Graham, Aaron Weiss, Chris Jakutas, Dominic Turpin, John Mithot, John Van Balaguyan, Matt Conroe, Pattern Shift, Pete Smoyer, Pierre Franson, Sea Green Mango, Stefan Bernegger, William Blair, Amira Sosnick, Andy and Wall, Benish Tech LLC, Brian Terry, David Charney, David Giltinen, David Hibbets, David Wallach, George Church, Hieronimo Castaldo, John Kozura, Joseph Dvorak, Ken Lapre, Kiliaopu, Laird Whitehill, Mark Armstrong, Matt Glasser, Nick Winley, Patrick Dennis, Pedro Texera, Rafael Wojcik, Randall Slimak, Rick DeWitt, Ron Schiffman, Sean Foley, Steve Guderian, Adam Robinson, Adrian Griffiths, Alan Parikh, Andres Chovanec, Arnulfo Zepeda, Ben Head, Bob Shire, Brainwise, Brett Minder, Cameron Sowards, Carl Ittings, Casey Haskins, Dan Steelen, Dana Bridges, David Taschioni, David Wolf, Diana Nevins, Eric Zetterbaum, Flo, Fraser Kane, Glenn McDavid, Ira Cohen, James Bryson Hyatt, James Nance, James Page, Jason Luttrell, Jason McCampbell, Javier Zazo, Catherine S., Kelly Kudrick, Lockwood Carlson, Mark Bergeron, Mark Bloor, Mark Langston, Mark Van Coy, Matt Reno, Michael Hall, Michael Prochota, Michael Savuto, Naked Bunny with a Whip, Nathan Hannon, Neil Flood, Owen Mann, Pam Harris, Paul Lester, Pavel Zuzelski, Phil Hallenborg, Philip Francis, Rich Weigel, Richard Schwartz, Robert Thibodeau, Roger Dennis, Ron Lyle, Rushin Shah, Steve Nordhoff, Stuart Lending, Terry McKeon, Tom Van Scotter, Tomas Ault, Tomas Walgren, Wayne Pierkarski, Weller Tractor Salvage, William Vandenhuvel, and Youngco S. Thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we'll see you back here next time for more Starts With a Bang.